shorter than expected.
The baseball world today focuses on one man. Last year, Steven Strasburg was Major League Baseball's number one draft pick. Today, he makes his big league debut as a pitcher for the Washington Nationals. Strasburg, known for 100-mile-an-hour fastballs, for a knee-buckling curve and a baffling changeup as well. Joining us now is our friend, New York Times reporter Alan Schwartz, who's covered baseball phenoms for the past 20 years. He's with us from his office in New York. Alan, nice to have you back on the program.
It's very good to be here, Neil. Thank you for having me.
And this kid has yet to throw one pitch in the major leagues, yet some say before he even does so, he's one of the best pitchers in the major leagues.
Well, he has the tools to be, and he has pitched in the minor leagues well enough to make it reasonable to think that he will be immediately successful. But I think we should all take a little bit of a chill pill here. And he has yet to throw a major league pitch, and people are already talking about, hey, he might win 300 games. And, you know, I mean, come on, folks. Let's keep some perspective. I've been around baseball long enough to have seen plenty of phenoms, and they often become very good players. But let's let them do that first. Let's enjoy Steven Strasburg for what he is, not what we think he might be.
And the names that immediately come to mind, Mark Pryor, Kerry Wood.
Yeah, I mean, but Kerry Wood wasn't even quite as ballyhooed. Mark Pryor was the most comparable pitcher. I mean, he was this robotic kid with tall calves like rump roasts, had perfect mechanics, threw a little bit in the minor leagues after being the number two pick in the draft that year for various reasons. And he even won in his debut. He threw six innings and beat the Pirates, same team that Steven Strasburg is pitching against tonight. This is in 2002, got the win. But then, you know, Mark Pryor fell apart several years later, lots of injuries, and he's out of baseball now, which was unfathomable 8 years ago. So, you know, I'm the guy who made the world safe for Brian Taylor. You remember him. So I think I'm entitled to a little bit of reluctance to overhype guys. I mean, David Clyde is the most prominent example. He was a high school pitcher, admittedly. He was only 18, but mm-hmm. The Texas Rangers, similarly sort of flailing for attendance. Well, not similarly, but they were flailing for attendance. Washington's actually been very measured about this. But the owner was drawing 9,000 people a game. Then next thing you know, the hometown kid gets to start, and they drew 36,000 fans for the kid's first game. And, of course, the occasion was marked with Polynesian dancers, live lion cubs, and one papier-mâché giraffe. So, you know, sometimes teams can get a little overboard, but tonight it's going to be fun to watch the kid pitch. It's going to be fun to watch the kid pitch every time, just like it is to watch a lot of the great players in the big leagues, and he probably will soon be one of the very good ones.
And this is, you think of 1968, the year of the pitcher. Three should have been perfect games, two and 99.99% perfect games, and a no-hitter already this year. Home runs are down. The ERAs are down as well. You've got a flock of pitchers with ERAs under 3, which you normally considered Cooperstown stuff.
Well, it's also early in the year. And it's too early to make any pronouncements on, you know, what role the weather, ballparks, things like that are playing with the statistics. Certainly, we just came through a very high offensive era. It was that way for many reasons. Some people would say chemically induced. Certainly, the strike zone was way too small. It's gotten bigger, both in by law and in practice from the umpires. And so we'll see. It was perfect games are a complete fluke. Certainly in my opinion. There weren't any in 1968, for example, but Bob Gibson had a 1.12 ERA and the American League hit 230. So we ain't seeing that for a long time. It's just that, you know, offense is a little bit down right now, and we've seen some pretty wildly pitched games. And it's fun. It's nice to get a little bit of a change of pace.
Oh, Alan, I thought you were going to come out and demand we lower the mound again.
No. Absolutely not. Expand the strike zone. That's what I say.
Alan Schwartz, thanks very much. And we'll be both watching tonight as Steven Strasburg makes his auspicious debut for the Washington Nationals.
Oh, my pleasure, Neil. Anytime. Take care.
Alan Schwartz covers sports for the New York Times. He's the author of The Numbers Game, Baseball's Lifelong Fascination with Statistics, and joined us from his office in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
Today we continue our series, Setting Out, about young people out of college and looking for work. Today, reporter Nyla Boodoo of member station WLRN in Miami has the story of a new graduate who is trying to launch his career as an air traffic controller.
Summer means people in Miami want to use their backyard pools all the time. But recent college graduate Yoelvis Bengochea hopes this summer marks his last one cleaning those pools. Yoelvis just graduated from Miami-Dade College with an associate's degree in aviation management. He wants to work as an air traffic controller. He's 25 and originally started college right out of high school at nearby Barry University.
I went there for like a year and a half, and then I decided to take a break, and it became a long break.
After dropping out, he worked as a lifeguard until he got married and had a son. That's when he decided to go into the family business, cleaning pools. Yoelvis makes $400 a week and is paying off $9,000 in student loans. When his daughter was born more than a year ago, he realized he needed another career.
Running a business is a lot harder than people think. You give more hours than anybody else.
Yoelvis and his older sister were born in Havana, Cuba. They're the first generation of their family to go to college. Their mother, Maria Alvarez, started and still runs the family business, Hialeah Pool Supply.
Muy, muy contenta.
¿Por qué?
Porque, bueno, es un éxito que
she says she's very happy that Yoelvis has graduated. She thinks it's a great success and good for his future. The possibility of a college education is one of the biggest reasons she brought the family from Cuba when Yoelvis was just 8 years old.
I came here so they would have a chance at a prosperous future and have many more opportunities. In Cuba, opportunities are few. That's why it was important that they come to this country.
Back at one of the 15 pools he plans to clean today, Yoelvis pulls out his brush and starts scrubbing. It's getting hot.
See that little green? It's a little bit of algae. And like all the dust on the bottom is that black stuff.
So you're kind of an expert on pools, huh?
I don't know about an expert. I know a little bit of it. More than I want to know.
When Yoelvis went back to school, he went nonstop and finished the 2-year program early. As an air traffic controller, Yoelvis will likely start at a small airport, making about $45,000 a year. His goal is to work at Miami International Airport, where he could make more than $100,000. Right now, he's waiting for his paperwork to be processed. Then he'll apply with the Federal Aviation Administration.
I think I'll find a job, but it just takes a while, probably around a year.
Yoelvis did his research before he enrolled at Miami-Dade College, and he knows the industry's history. In 1981, thousands of new air traffic controllers came on board after a strike and a mass firing. Those people are now approaching the mandatory retirement age. Until a job opens up, for Yoelvis, there's still the pool.
This job is not bad for somebody that doesn't have a degree or anything, or that's coming from another country and whatever they study is not validated here. It pays pretty good for cleaning pools. It's not a bad job, it's just not for me.
When Yoelvis leaves the family company, his mom says he'll be greatly missed. But there's a part-time pool cleaner who's also anxious for Yoelvis to get that FAA job, because he'll be able to start working full-time. For NPR News, I'm Nyla Boodoo in Miami.
Tomorrow we go to South Dakota and meet an Air Force veteran who is now armed with a new business degree.
The military helped me out with this degree, so essentially the money's coming from taxpayers and everything. I really don't want to let it go to waste.
That's tomorrow as our series continues on Morning Edition.
It's a staggering figure. Each year, an estimated 340,000 women die in childbirth. The vast majority of those deaths occur in developing countries, but progress is being made. Even so, women's groups and health experts meeting in Washington this week are seeking $12 billion to improve women's rights and health. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
This year, the issue of maternal health has risen to the top of the international development agenda. Thousands of women country representatives and health experts are at the Washington conference called Women Deliver. They're focusing on a central fact of women's lives, that they have babies, often not in the best of circumstances. The delegates are hearing from people like Dr. Farhana Dewan, an obstetrician and gynecologist from Bangladesh. 85% of the women there still live in rural areas, but the government is making a big effort to deliver babies safely at new district health centers and in rural homes.
We have trained people to go and serve in the periphery at the grassroots level, and also we have thought, well, all the women will not be able to come to the center to come and deliver. So what can we do? We can train people to go and deliver them at home and refer the women in case of complications.
The women in these areas don't really have the power to decide for themselves that they want to go to the health centers.
The women who are illiterate, who are in the village, they have to depend on the opinion of their husband and the mother-in-law and in-laws and all that.
So the government offers vouchers as an incentive to get them into health centers.
Of course, she has to be poor. They won't give it to the rich people. And when she comes for checkup, she gets money. And when she comes for delivery, she gets money. The response is very good because women who get money, they go back and send some other people also.
Since 1990, the government's efforts have reduced deaths from pregnancy and childbirth by 53%. The idea is catching on in sub-Saharan Africa as well. But in many villages, it's the elders who have to be acknowledged, says Mary Isaka, a midwife from eastern Ghana.
We have the opinion leaders making decisions for the woman. If a woman is in labor, she cannot just get up by herself and go to a health facility by herself. She cannot make a decision by herself unless the opinion leader says so.
Isaka persuaded the village elders that it was better for the women to seek her out when they went into labor.
You know, they feel that if you deliver by yourself, it shows that you are faithful to your husband, or you feel that you are brave. So we made them to understand that, no, if you want to show bravery at the end of it, you die or you lose your baby, you've lost.
Since the government started providing free health care to pregnant women in 2003, no woman has died and no woman has lost a baby in her district. Isaka, who is being honored as Midwife of the Year at the Women Deliver Conference, says she shares her duties with one other midwife in an area of 20,000 people. Maternal health is improving in many countries around the world, in Sri Lanka, Egypt, Honduras, and Rwanda. Governments are educating women, improving their status, and providing family planning. But some of these gains are being offset by AIDS. Frederica Hansen, the United Nations Population Fund's advisor in Ghana, says AIDS carries such a stigma that it keeps pregnant women from seeking care.
When these women die, we don't get to know about it. They just bury them silently.
A recent study found that there would have been 60,000 fewer pregnancy-related deaths if it had not been for AIDS. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The sensitive salt marshes of Louisiana line the coast, protecting it from storm surges and providing habitat for wildlife. Well, now, those marshes are in danger and covered in oil. But what to do about that, if anything at all, isn't clear. NPR's Tamara Keith spent the day touring the marshes by airboat.
About 150 miles of Louisiana coastline have been affected by oil, much of it marshland. And we're out here near some of this affected marshland. There's absorbent boom that they've placed around the marsh grasses, but the oil has definitely gotten in. Around the edges, it's brown and glistening. The blades of grass have oil on them. There's a crew of workers adjusting the boom. They're all in these white Tyvek suits, protective suits with life vests on, and they're taking this boom that looks sort of like a cotton snake and pushing it up right up against the edge of the marsh grasses.
I mean, actually, over the last few days, there's been an improvement. You can see an improvement.
John Miller is a petty officer with the U.S. Coast Guard.
And so between the boom, absorbent boom, between the process of biodegradation and between the heat, I mean, some of it's evaporating off, too. This is a small success story.
Another thing they're doing on a limited basis is actually cleaning up the most heavily oiled grasses by hand.
We pull the boats as close as safe, and then you have the workers like leaning over the gunwales with absorbent pads, cleaning it off grass blade by grass blade as well.
But scientists involved with the cleanup have moved away from that effort, and not just because there are way too many grass blades and way too much oil. In fact, they say it's not all that effective. They say the primary goal of cleanup around marshes is to scoop up the oil before it ever has a chance to get in. And then there's an element of just letting nature take its course. Professor Denise Reed is a marsh expert at the University of New Orleans.
Originally, you saw pictures of people going out there and wiping the oil off of the grass, and they were probably bending and twisting and destroying as many plants as they were actually doing good by cleaning and with the trampling and everything. And so now that's not happening, and that's not happening because it's probably not the right thing to do.
There are competing theories about the best way to handle the arrival of oil in coastal marshes. Some say the oil should be burned off. Others say cut the grasses out. Reed says different methods are right for different areas. It may seem counterintuitive, but she says getting in there and trying to help could slow down the recovery process.
The good news is that within the marsh environments in Louisiana, that there are a lot of naturally occurring microbes that will degrade this oil, and those processes will take care of it.
It could be that when it comes to fragile marshes, less is more. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Cocodrie, Louisiana.
Coim Toibin is the author of many novels. His latest is called Brooklyn. His books deal with themes of personal loss, identity, and the history of Ireland. For our series You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love, Toibin recommends an author whose work was sometimes banned in his native Ireland.
Early in 1989, the Irish novelist John McGahern came to my house in Dublin for supper. He had not published a novel for 10 years. I knew, because he had told me in a number of letters, that he had been struggling with a novel. And I knew also, because he had said so, that he sometimes believed that he was finished as a novelist, even though he was still only in his mid-50s. Over supper, we did not mention novels. And it was only when he was going that I noticed a large envelope on the hall table. "Have a look at that," he said shyly, before leaving my house. It was a photocopy of a typescript of a new novel which was called Amongst Women. I spent the next day reading it. I wrote to say that he had, after a long struggle, produced a masterpiece, which seemed effortless, but also dark, filled with truths that had seldom been explored in fiction with the same precision and depth. It began with one of the great opening sentences. As he weakened, Moran became afraid of his daughters. McGahern's version of what love and togetherness do to families was dramatic and stark. Love in the world made by Moran was filled with threats of violence, bullying efforts to control, and the need to ritualize. At the heart of the book was a brilliant and subversive idea that Ireland, rather than being a nation or a community, was a place of isolated families, bitter individuals, and gnarled relationships. But McGahern was too subtle a novelist even to mention this idea in the book. Instead, he allowed it to emerge subtly and slowly. The pacing of the novel is masterly. Its rhythms are filled with hidden emotion. The writing is plain, unshowy, and has a strange, truthful edge to it. Pauses like pauses in a prayer or a ballad. It is the sort of book which you can give anyone of any age and know that they will be changed by it. It took 10 years to write. Its power will last for many centuries.
Coim Toibin's latest novel is called Brooklyn. He recommends the novel Amongst Women by John McGahern for our series You Must Read This. You'll find more book reviews and recommendations at our website, npr.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Monopoly, the board game, requires many things, and at the top of that list would be time and patience. It seems you can pass go and collect your $200 for days before someone, anyone at the table actually manages to win. So Dan Myers, a professor of sociology at the University of Notre Dame, wondered how long the shortest possible game of Monopoly would take. And after deriving what we shall call Meyer's theorem, he and his son acted out their theoretical shortest possible Monopoly game.
Ready? Go. 12, Electric Company. 12, Illinois Avenue. 9, Convenience Chest. Collect $200.
4, Income Tax. 11, Pennsylvania.
4, Park Place. I'll take it. 2, Boardwalk. I'll take it. 4, Baltic Avenue. $200 for going around. I'll take 5 houses.
7, Chance. Go to Boardwalk. I'm bankrupt.
21 seconds. Professor Myers, how many moves, actually, would there be in such a short game?
There's actually 2 turns per player, and it's a total of 9 rolls of the dice, actually.
Because somebody rolls doubles at some
point. Right, and so their turn continues after the doubles.
Well, take us through the game here. What happens at the beginning?
One player moves around the board very quickly to buy a Boardwalk and Park Place and places houses on them, and the other one ends up drawing a chance card that sends them to Boardwalk, and they don't have enough money to pay the rent with 3 houses, and the game is over.
And you and your son were sort of playing at high speed, and did it all under half a minute. But in reality, such a game could take just a couple of minutes if people played.
That's right.
If those rolls of the dice actually happened.
That's right. And it's very, very unlikely, of course. And people out in the blogosphere have calculated the odds of that game happening now, and it's in the 1 in quadrillion range. But it's a theoretically possible game, yes.
Has peer review in the blogosphere generally approved of you as having the shortest game, or has somebody come up with a theoretically shorter game so far?
Well, there have been some proposals for some that are shorter, and so we're going to have to check those out, but we're confident we're in the top handful, even if we're not number one.
How long did it take you to come up with this theory of the shortest Monopoly game?
This is actually a project that started a long time ago, just me and my son trying to figure out how to play shorter and shorter games of Monopoly, but it's been about 3 weeks now that we decided that we wanted to see what the shortest possible game could be. And we spent a couple of days working through different possibilities to come up with the one that we present on the YouTube video.
Monopoly famously was popular in the Great Depression when people were going broke. And now you've come back during the Great Recession of the 21st century with this theory.
Yeah. Well, there have been some comments out on the blogosphere about how it's representative of what's going on in our economy, that people could go bankrupt so quickly. We didn't intend a parallel, but certainly it's been drawn by a number of people out there.
Well, what will fill the void now that's occupied you for the past few weeks?
Well, we've been getting suggestions from those out in the blog world, so the next one is to try to play the shortest possible game of Risk.
Which you think might be more complicated?
I think it will, because making someone go bankrupt isn't quite as complicated as world domination.
Well, Professor Myers, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Dan Myers, sociology professor at the University of Notre Dame. He has developed, along with his son, the shortest possible game of Monopoly.